The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Okay, well, as Peggy was saying, we're talking during the break that the Ritholtz organization and Ritholtz Wealth Management up on the East Coast certainly get some talented people.
Absolutely.
Barry and Josh, and I think this is the third in the triumvirate, Mr. Ben Carlson. Ben Carlson's with us today. His background is he's the director of institutional asset management at Ritholtz Capital Management. But I'll have to say, reading the information and the articles that were sent, he is one heck of a writer. And I think all of us need to go out and get this book. He's written a book called A Wealth of Common Sense, which, you know, if there's one thing you need in investing, is common sense. Why simplicity trumps complexity in any investment plan. And that's brought out by Bloomberg Press and John Wiley & Sons. So I'm pleased this morning to have with us Mr. Ben Carlson. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And great writing. I do not have the book yet, but I will before the day's out. I'm pretty good at ordering. I've got pretty good at ordering on Amazon now. I assume you wrote the book in the same way you write your articles, and it's pretty phenomenal. It's really interesting, and I really love the title. I know you have a lot of exposure because you all manage money for both institutions and I assume high net worth individuals. So you have a lot of exposure to the investing public out there. Do you find that they understand what they're investing in?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of times that's one of the biggest problems with the world of finance is that in the past, the way that things operated was the people who manage money would kind of just say, trust us, we got this, and really talk over people's heads and not really – a lot of people didn't really understand what they were investing in or what was going on in their portfolio, and I think a lot of that has changed in the information age. So I think people really want to know what's going on now, and I think the communication aspect of being a financial advisor or working in some sort of capacity in investments is that you really have to break things down into simple parts so people that are investing in it can understand, because most people that are investing with you don't have the time or the energy or the resources to really follow this stuff on a daily basis.
Right. Now, I've been in the business 40 years, and many times I've seen products as they bring them down to my level to explain them to me, and I've seen products where I thought Wall Street intentionally created a product that was very difficult to understand. A lot of the derivative products, for instance, that caused us so much trouble back in 2008, I think you'd have to be a PhD in mathematics and probably use IBM's computer to try to work through some of that stuff, because some of those things were so complicated they just melted into themselves. Do you think that Wall Street learned its lesson? Do you think we have fewer products coming out that are really very, very complicated, or do you see the complexity of Wall Street continuing to grow?
No, I think it's kind of a double-edged sword now that we have. I think it's probably the best time to be an individual investor that we've ever had, because costs are lower than ever. But the flip side of that is that there's so many choices now for investors. There's something like 2,000 ETFs now. There's 7,000 mutual funds, and like you said, a lot of these products they're not made to be bought; they're made to be sold. And
right.
So Wall Street is really trying to. A lot of times they chase performance worse than anyone else, and they just come out with the new product du jour that hits sort of the latest fad investment craze. And if it doesn't work, they throw it to the wayside and it goes away, and they'll be right back with something new the next time around. So I think the amount of choice is great for individual investors, but trying to sort of wade through all that and figure out what makes sense and what doesn't is really difficult these days.
Yeah, I do. I agree. I think it's very, very difficult for the average consumer. So I think most of them just turn around and they kind of leave it to their advisor. And you had a great article in here that I was very interested in about a case, I guess, in Michigan that with Elsa Prince Brock. I don't know how to say that last name. Brockheisen?
Yep.
And her living trust, where her advisor, who was no spring chicken, I think he, at the time this came out, was 68 years old. had made poor decisions on the behalf of her and her ex-husband, and totaled some losses between 50 and 60 million. Now, they had a lot of money to lose, but still, that's ridiculous. We can be a little bit too trusting of some of the advisors, can we not?
Yeah, definitely. I think as a client, I think it's a really good idea to outsource to a professional, because, like I said, people don't have the time and the energy or the understanding or expertise to really do it on their own, but that doesn't save you from paying attention. So I think that really understanding what's going on with your money, and really paying attention and just asking questions of your advisor. Again, I don't think this whole idea of trust us, we got it, is going to fly anymore, because you just have to continue to pay attention and hold them accountable. And I think the biggest thing is just to know what you own and why you own it, and then, you know, setting reasonable expectations so you can kind of track performance along the way to make sure that things are on the up and up, and that you're not being taken advantage of.
Yeah, and you have in there, you had a list of things. Ben wrote a blog called The Cost of Not Paying Attention. It's excellent. You should look it up, March 24th of this year. And you had in there, establish investment policies, prepare a written investment plan, monitor the results, ensure the portfolio is diversified, control and account for all investment-related expenses, avoid conflicts of interest. That's the hardest one for people, is it not?
That's
the hardest thing about the whole investment process. It looks like, as the new rules are coming in from the DOL and 1502, that's going to be the hardest thing, period, I think, is the where the conflicts of interest come into play.
Yeah, and I think the big thing there to remember is that there's always going to be some sort of conflict of interest, because, listen, as an advisor, you're trying to make a living and you have to get paid. So I think the biggest thing there is not just to avoid conflicts of interest, but to be open and honest about them and transparent and say, this is exactly how we get paid. This is where our money comes from. This is where our fees come from. So I think it's just really about being open and upfront and honest about where that paycheck is coming from. And a lot of times, investors don't really even know where their money's going and how it's being used to expense to that advisor.
Yeah, I think that's great legislation, because, I mean, obviously most people don't think you're doing it for free, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, they would kind of like to know exactly, you know, how much am I, you know, where, like you just said, where's my money going? And I think it's a fair thing for them to know, because it helps them know when they break even, you know. I just think it's a much fairer thing to do. I don't know if this thing is going to spread out over other parts of our economy. I, for one, like to buy nice cars. I'd love to know how much the dealer really made out of the deal and the guy selling it to me and stuff like that. I've never actually really known.
Not want to know.
Well, I may not, but I mean, it would seem to give me a little more leverage with negotiating, if that were true. So I don't know.
Well, and the way that I look at it is operating in the best interest of your client should seem like a no-brainer. And this is kind of the thing that, like, a lawyer has the same rules. If a lawyer wasn't acting in your best interest, then why would you hire them? And they have that standard as well. It's just like a doctor. So it seems like a no-brainer that it's taken so long to get to this point that you should act in the best interest of your clients and be open and honest with them. But the sort of incentives of Wall Street have really held this one down, I think.
Yeah, well, this is when, as I said, I've been around 40 years. The way I kind of looked at it is that Wall Street's argued so much against it, it must be really good for the consumer. So otherwise, their attempts to keep status quo certainly is not usually good for the consumer. Ben, if you'll stay with us, I've got 1,000 more questions to ask, and we'll have you on the other side. Stay with us, folks. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. We've got Ben Carson with us today, Director of Institutional Asset Management at Ritholtz Wealth Management. Back in a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We're pleased this morning to have with us Mr. Ben Carlson. Ben is the Director of Institutional Asset Management at Ritholtz Capital Management. We were talking a bit during the break. Find out he is actually headquartered up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Wonderful place to live. And Ben, prior to joining Ritholtz, was really in one of the largest family offices, I think, in the United States, running a foundation. I assume that's what it was for the Van Ando family. Is that correct? Was that a family foundation or?
So it was an endowment fund for a nonprofit actually that they started.
Okay, but they have a very big family office, right?
Oh yeah, correct. Yes. Yeah. Both families too.
And so, I just want to ask your opinion. What's your opinion on family offices? Do you think they are a necessary function when families get to a certain size? And at what size do you think would be triggered to that point where, hey, when you get to this point, maybe you ought to consider having a family office?
Yeah, I definitely think it can help. And one of the biggest things is a lot of very wealthy families really like to have they like to be anonymous, and they like to sort of keep things close to the vest. And don't like other people, you know, at big firms looking over all of their business. So if you can hire a few people to sort of run the money in-house for you, it can be more convenient. You can have more control. The downside is you really have to know who you're hiring and why. And you'll have to make sure that they have the sort of capabilities to manage that money because at a larger firm you have, many more people to work with. There could be scale for lower costs. So it's really more of a convenience factor. I think you probably need in the order of a couple hundred million dollars probably for it to make sense from a cost perspective, because you're probably going to want a few people working there because we're talking estate planning, taxes, investment management, all this stuff, and it can get, and we're talking even budgeting and that sort of thing. So it's your whole sort of financial life. So I definitely think you need to be a fairly good size. Portfolio for that to make sense.
Right. What would be your advice to the average investor in terms of how they should control their money, how they should structure it? You had a great article, One Way to Beat the Market, in terms of you were talking about different types of portfolios that had beaten the market. But one of the things that Ritz-Holtz does, I know, is they give great advice to the average consumer on how to handle their money in a pretty complicated world. You have any specific advice on how to do that?
Well, I think the biggest thing for most people, a lot of people get bogged down in the details, and they want to know which fund to pick right now, and they want to know which sector or segment of the market to be in. And I'm sure that stuff matters, but the biggest thing for most people is really to just have a plan. Most people just don't have a plan or a process in place that they can follow. And the way that we look at it is there's a lot of different roads to Rome. There's a lot of ways to make money, but there's also many, many more ways to sort of lose money and do bad. So I think the first thing is just really having a plan that matches your personality and that you can stick with over time, and just being able to follow it. I think that's a huge advantage that a lot of people don't really take that necessary first step.
All right, so you set up a plan, and what would be the next step after the plan?
So, I mean...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, once you have a plan and a philosophy in place, the hardest part is really the implementation and following it. So it's sort of finding those different inputs for your life and changes in, your family or your job or your career and how much you're saving. And so there's so many different inputs that I think the really hard part is just sticking with it and making changes when necessary. And the real hard part is not making any changes when they aren't necessary, because a lot of times the best move you can make is just to do nothing and follow your plan. But the markets get crazy, and people get people panic, or people get greedy when markets are up, and they decide to make changes to their portfolio based on their emotions rather than what's going on in their life and what's going on in the markets. And that's when people get into trouble. So I think the really hard part is just implementing and following a set of guidelines that you've put in place up front.
Now I'm going to switch a little bit and get to the asset management side of your business. What areas do you like right now? I mean, first of all, what is your thought about this market? There's so many people out there that have come out that really consistently are saying this market isn't going anywhere this year. What side do you fall on?
Yeah, I mean that's certainly possible. It's interesting. Last week I looked at some analysis from Jim Paulson, who works for Wells Capital Management, and he said this is not a bull market or a bear market, it's a bunny market, because we just hop around, but we don't really go anywhere.
Right.
And so I looked at the numbers, and it's interesting, the amount of times that the market over a 2 to 3 year period has been basically flat. So I call that from negative 5% to positive 5%. It's only happened about 5 to 7% of the time. So it's very odd that we actually have that flat of a market, but it certainly looks like it's very possible this year. And I think investors just have to kind of remember what they're trying to do. And I think if you're a saver and you're saving on a consistent basis, a flat market can be a good thing. If you're an investor with a portfolio who has needs for your portfolio to grow, it can be kind of frustrating. But I think the fact that we've had such a great run in the U.S. really makes sense for investors to think globally these days, because a lot of the world stock markets haven't really kept pace with the U.S. over the last few years. So I think although some of those markets are scary, the reason they're scary and the reason they're a little bit cheaper than the U.S. is because they've had some bad news. But I think it really makes sense for investors to think globally these days.
So you want them to look past the bad news. What about the zero interest rate markets? That's another thing that's concerning people. Is a lot of economies have started zero interest rate policies. Nobody has any idea how that's going to come from, or even negative interest rates.
No, it's funny. Yeah, all my economics textbooks, I remember telling me that the lowest interest rates could go is zero, and we've seen that theory busted in the last couple of years. It really is. It's interesting, and it's like kind of an experiment that we're viewing here. I think you do have to think about interest rates not only on a nominal basis, but on a real basis. So we're seeing deflation in some of these countries, and so they're not having any inflation. So on a real basis, maybe these rates have been seen in the past. But it's certainly more of a psychological thing, I think. And I think as far as the central banks go, it's really about of trust and how are people comfortable with what their actions are. And I don't really know how these things are going to work out, but I think it is definitely scary, and that's one of the reasons that a lot of those countries have performed much worse than the U.S. over the last 5 years, as we're kind of the cleanest dirty shirt in the hamper, so to speak.
I've got about a minute to go. Any specific areas in the U.S. market that you like? Any sectors or anything out there? This is your hot tip moment.
You know, I think that small caps and mid caps have gotten really dinged pretty good lately, and someone at our firm did some research the other day that said small caps fell close to 30%, which if that would have happened to the S&P 500, it would have taken us back to 2007 levels. So I think the sort of riskier parts of the market are fairly overlooked these days.
Okay. All right. Well, that's excellent. Well, listen, thank you so much, Ben, for being with us. Appreciate it. How do people follow you? Just
Wealth of Common Sense.
Yep. Is that it? Is that a blog? I'm not into blogs, so I don't know how to do that.
So Wealth of Common Sense is my blog and my book. You can Google that, and you should be able to find me.
I'm getting a book, so I appreciate it. Thank you so much, sir. Have a great day.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.